You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. We are so pleased to welcome Hanya Yanagihara here tonight to talk about her passionately admired novel, A Little Life, with Matthew Spector. Matthew is a founding editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books. He's a screenwriter, and he's the author, most recently, of the novel American Dream Machine, set in Los Angeles in the 60s. Looks like a fabulous book, and we have it for sale afterwards. Hanya Yanagihara was born here in Los Angeles, but she has been a longtime resident of Lower Manhattan, from which she roamed far and wide for many years as a writer and editor for Condé Nast Traveler. She's now the deputy editor of the New York Times Tea Magazine, which I look forward to when it comes on Sunday. Her first novel, The People in the Trees, was a decade in the making, an anthropological adventure story with a profound and tragic vision of what happens when cultures collide. It was widely praised as one of the best novels of 2013. The People in the Trees, as I mentioned, was a decade in the making. A Little Life was written in 18 months. One of the most talked about books of last year, the novel follows over several decades a group of four friends who have been together since college and have settled in Manhattan. There is Willem, a handsome Swedish-American actor from Wyoming, Malcolm, a biracial architect from the Tony Upper East Side, JB, a gay Haitian-American artist from Brooklyn, and Jude, a charismatic and disfigured young attorney of indeterminate origin. What they all hold in common? Friendship and ambition. So there are few people whom I've met, who've read this novel, whose reaction does not register on the scale of passion. And I know that many of you are here in this room tonight, is that right? Many of you readers of this book, myself among them. Yes, it's a pretty powerful experience. And you understand then this paraphrase of Jude's line in the book, which can pertain to this darkly beautiful book. It can drive you mad, consume you, and take over your life. Please welcome Matthew Spector and Hanya Yanagihara to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Well, Matthew and I have already discussed everything backstage.
We did. Yeah, we wore it out.
Goodbye. So,
yeah. Actually, I'm amazed that I made it from backstage to this chair without falling flat on my face. I spilled wine on my shirt.
Right.
I disabled my microphone with some weird bit of gesticulation. And I thought for a second, maybe I will come out on stage like covered in bruises and forced to...
Well, it's the top of the evening.
Well, I also thought, you know, that would be somehow weirdly fitting.
Yeah, an apt metaphor.
Both for where one is left as a reader at the end of this book, and maybe also as a sort of parallel to where I thought we could start, because I'm going to be mindful. I'm sure many of you have read the book, but perhaps some of you have not. So I'm gonna try and I'm not a big fan of the idea of spoiler, but I feel like there's plenty to talk about that will preserve the book's mystery and some of its difficult disclosures, but it is impossible, I think, to think about this book without thinking first about Jude. As you know, the book is the story of these four friends, but Jude is somehow the looms the largest,
right?
Perhaps, and I remember that you said somewhere that that Jude sort of came to you fully formed. You know, that somebody had asked you a question about Jude in an interview, and you said, "Well, he came to me fully formed." And I'm curious, is that where you started, where this book started?
Yes, I mean, I always say that, you know, and this is true, I wanted to write a book with a protagonist who never got better. And what is it like? How could you create narrative tension and a sense of narrative momentum when you have a character who, and I think we're used to reading in novels, sort of starts off here and ends up here? And what if you had a character who started off here and ended up here as well? What would be the tension and what would be the thrust of that book? And also, it wasn't meant to be an answer exactly to redemption narratives, which we're so fond of in this culture in particular. Mm-hmm. But I do think that, you know, the idea that we all have in within us the capability to find redemption for ourselves, or that it's promised to all of us, is a kind of hopefulness that can be oppressive. And some of this book is about the search for happiness and how oppressive and impossible that is, and how unkind we are to people who can't find it for themselves, mm-hmm. and also about how there's a certain amount of trauma that some people are unable to make it back from. And so I wanted to have a book that began in one place, and you thought it was one kind of book, you know, a post-collegiate New York book, which is a subgenre I love, uh-huh. and then slowly becomes something else, and you don't quite know what that something else is.
Right.
But Jude is a character, yes, did come to me pretty fully formed, and he was a very easy character to write in the sense that he doesn't really change that much over the course of the book. Mm-hmm. His logic is his own, and he never really is able to get past the lessons that he was taught as a child.
Right. But he may not change, and I like what you say, you know, the oppressiveness of hopeful narratives, because I thought, you know, on some level, this is the inverse of that. There are aspects of the narrative that are oppressive, and yet there is something weirdly hopeful, a little bit.
Yeah.
Perhaps even more than a little bit in its conclusion. You know, it is a very painful book to read, but it does not strike me as being purely a miserable book.
Right. I mean, it's. Yeah.
Or is it?
I mean, no. It wasn't meant to be misery porn, and I think there are books that are misery porn. And,
right.
You know, there's. I think one of the arguments that I had with my editor was this idea of what is too much for a reader to bear, uh-huh. and also this accompanies that question: what is too much for a character to bear? And the question is neither. You know, as a writer, you get nowhere trying to second guess what a reader can or cannot handle. You know, as a reader, all I want is a consistent and well-formed logical universe, and that's it. And if you start sort of guessing, you know, as a writer, you're not the reader's babysitter. You're not their nanny. You're not there to try to guesstimate how much they can handle. And also, if your characters need to suffer because their life is suffering, mm-hmm. then what you're asking the reader to do is bear witness to that character. And there are points in this book in which, you know, the characters know more than the reader, and there are points in which the readers know more than the characters themselves. But there are also points in the book where Jude is left alone and the only company he has is the reader.
Right.
This is not answering your question at all, but the point is that it isn't, I hope, misery for misery's sake to gawk at the misery. It's misery because so many people's lives are misery, and it is our responsibility to look at them.
Right. Right. You've just alluded to the fights that you had, which I feel like we've been talking about a bit. And I'll circle back to that because they're fun.
Because I won them. That's why they're fun.
You want them. Right. So you went in spoiling for...
Exactly.
Yeah. But when you say Jude doesn't, you know, the character doesn't really change, you know, he may not, but of course the book proceeds by kind of revealing what his history is and what is, you know, I sort of felt at the beginning when we first encountered Jude and these characters, they're moving into their, you know, their first apartment out of college, and you know, we understand that Jude has some trouble occasionally walking or with his legs. We have no idea why. And, you know, it almost felt like, it made me think of the story about Henry James and his obscure hurt.
Yeah.
Right. There's a famous narrative about Henry James is that he had an injury of some kind when he was a boy, and he referred to it in his letters as the obscure hurt. Mm. And there are all these kind of scholarly theories about, you know, the theory for a long time was that he was, you know, celibate because his obscure hurt was the sort of thing that might have made him...
Senile.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Some sort of, like, groin wound.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the most recent theory is that, no, he just suffered from a bad back.
Oh, that's so much glamorous.
Which is really, you know, the, for Henry James, of course, this would have been the obscure. But, you know, I thought the book begins and you know, did you know at the beginning what Jude's history was, or was that a sort of something that you had to unwind?
This book, and I think it's not this way. I don't know if any of you are fiction writers, but it's certainly not this way for every book. It wasn't this way for my first book. But in this book, I knew exactly where I was going with this narrative. And I knew structurally what was going to happen. I knew the pace it would happen. I knew the last lines of it.
Uh-huh.
I knew what he would suffer from. Now, as I started doing reporting, that changed a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Just the conditions that he had, how it would manifest itself into greater sort of troubles for him later on as he got older.
Mm-hmm.
But I did know. And in the first section of the book, he really doesn't appear at all. And it's not just a trick to the reader, but it's also meant to be a foil a bit.
You uh-huh.
know, not that the characters are simple, the other characters mm-hmm. have simple lives,
right.
but they have comparatively uncomplicated lives.
Right.
And they are meant to sort of be a reminder as you enter the next section of how strange Jude's life really is.
Right, right. And that's exactly right. At the beginning, we spend much more time with JB
yeah.
and with Malcolm, and the book really, really becomes, and with Willem.
Right.
And, you know, it feels very balanced between them, and then you're sort of like, and Jude's sort of over there, and,
yeah.
and that obviously
right.
Reverses,
right.
you know, as the book proceeds. You know, in terms of let's go to the fights. Since
okay.
It's there, you know, since everybody likes to hear about those.
Yeah.
And since you mentioned, you know, the your editor, you know, having that question of how much misery can a reader take, you know, my experience of reading it was that this did not strike me as a long novel, you know, it struck me as a novel that was sort somewhat to scale, you know, that the characters were drawn very 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 largely, and that, you know, the book did not seem you know, at any point slow or redundant, or, you know, I thought I had read that, you know, that Jerry had advocated, Jerry Howard being the editor in question, had advocated for some cutting, and I thought, what would you cut? What could you cut?
Yeah, and
what did he want to cut?
He didn't know either. So when I turned this in, the book was about 960 manuscript pages, and mm-hmm. that's what translates into a 720-page book
right.
once, you know, some clever typesetting is done. But he you know, so this book wasn't bought at first by the house. I wasn't mm-hmm. under contract. And he really didn't know what to do with it. And, you know, when your first book doesn't perform, as my first book doesn't, you aren't guaranteed that you'll have another book contract. And mm-hmm. he said, I want to cut by a third, but I don't know how to do it. And often, you know, an editor will say that, and they won't know how to do it, and it's not necessarily their job to know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But as strange as that sounds, but in this case, I knew it was only a business decision.
Right.
And that is something you have to take into consideration. Publishing is a business. It's a badly run one.
Right.
And no one in it is in it because they're great business people or it would make a lot more money. But you have to consider that. And
right.
I did think about it. But I think in general, when an editor can't tell you
uh-huh.
how you should do it at all, then you know it's not really a viable artistic decision.
Right. Right. Well, you worked in publishing, so you were able to know right away that to be able to understand
right.
that this was about the cost of
right.
of
yeah.
paper.
Yeah, it is right. about the cost of paper.
Right, which is amazing. I don't think yeah. most people. That was a shock to me too when I realized that I was getting some pushback with my last novel
right.
because you know
yeah
trees.
Because of trees
yeah. Yeah.
Those goddamn trees,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
But that's a big part of it. Mm-hmm.
You know? And you had worked with Jerry was the editor on the
first book as well, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did you fight a lot about that one too?
I think if any of you have worked with an editor, what a good editor will do is they will be able to pinpoint all of the parts in the book that you're most uncertain about and that you're wobbliest on.
Uh-huh.
And it is your job to really think, can I defend each and every one of these points? And if you can, I think that's fine and you should keep them. If you can't, it doesn't necessarily mean that their suggestion is the right one for the book, but it means that it's not fully cooked probably.
Right.
And so Jerry and I have different tastes, but one thing he was able to do with a sort of unsettling accuracy for both of these books
mm-hmm.
was find the areas that I couldn't quite figure out how to make perfect, and I just thought, oh, he'll never notice, and I'll turn it in.
Uh-huh.
But he was able to find all of those moments and marks.
Uh-huh.
And he was also able, you know, it's interesting when you have a reader who's different than you are, you know, who's older than you are, who's of a different gender, who's of a different race, who's raised under different circumstances, what they often see in the book is, to some extent, mirrors the interaction you'll be having with your reader because they're seeing a completely different book, and that sounds so obvious, but the first time it gets read by an other, by which I mean someone who's not your reader through the writing process,
right.
it's it's a very strange experience because they can often be reading something else. Mm-hmm. And you have to kind of figure out, okay, they're reading this book, I'm writing this book. Mm-hmm. What can I do to get him to get closer to my book?
Right, right. Do you have reliable readers outside, you know, people that you go
to? I do. I have one reader who's my best friend and an amazing editor. And it was a very involved editorial process with him. So I would finish one section and I would send it to him, mm-hmm. and he would write back with his immediate responses. Mm-hmm. And then I would send him about 10 to 12 questions, some of them big and some of them granular, and he'd write back to those. Mm-hmm. And then I'd send him another 10 to 12 and he'd write back to those. And then every Friday we met and talked about the book. Mm-hmm. And so the book really belongs in great part to him, uh-huh. and to what he saw in the book. I mean, there's one example that I always think about because he was able to articulate what I couldn't about the book. And there's a scene, there's a leitmotif in the book of hyenas that chase mm-hmm. Jude and that appear sort of midway through the book. And it was my friend, my reader, Jared, who said, I think the hyenas are sex. And it had never occurred to me that they were sex itself. But as soon as he said that, I knew he was right. And so a good reader can often sort of, you know, articulate what's subtext to you.
Yeah.
What you are sort of aware that you're trying to bubble out of the text, but you kind of don't know how to do it. And once they can articulate that, then you can actually consciously work towards implementing it
right.
and using that more and more throughout the rest of the narrative.
Right. Yeah, it's curious that. I mean, I always feel like I have a couple of readers who do that, and they'll, you know, inevitably give me an idea that I would never, that winds up being absolutely indispensable to the book's design, and I would never have gotten there by myself.
Yeah, exactly. You're just too close to it.
Yeah.
You can't see it after a certain point.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned a moment ago before you started reporting, and you know, I was also thinking about, you know, this book is pretty fluent in architecture, in law, in film, you know, each in art.
Yeah.
And you know, I did wonder, you know, what your research process was for it, because
I mean, one of the great uncelebrated things about writing fiction is that although people don't buy fiction, anyone will talk to you. You know, I mean, you probably know this too. You can call up anyone and say, I'm writing a novel, can I come talk to you about your job? And they'll say yes. And that is really remarkable. I mean, you can really get anyone. And uh-huh. I just called the director of NIH recently and I said, I'm doing something, can I come talk to you? And he said, yes.
Uh-huh.
That was amazing. But so I talked to people. I talked to people mostly behind the camera for Willem. Mm-hmm. And people behind the camera do not like actors and don't uh-huh. really did not have very nice things to say.
Right.
And I talked to an architect who worked at sort of a star architects firm. Mm-hmm. And I talked to a couple of doctors. And I talked to the most people for Jude. I talked to someone at every stage of his career. So I talked to a law student. I talked to a clerk. I talked to someone in the U.S. Attorney General's office. I talked to three litigators. And I talked to a litigator, a head of litigation, who was becoming a law professor at Rutgers.
Uh-huh.
And then after I was done, he read the book and marked it up. But the wonderful thing, I think, for novelists, because so many fiction writers, and I count myself among them, are very bad at writing about work. Uh-huh. And there's very few writers who can do it well. I mean, I always think of Robert Morgan, who wrote Gap Creek, because he writes physical labor so well. And because most writers, you know, what we do as work is fairly inert.
Right.
It typically tends to be unconvincing. And I wanted to make sure I really got work, because it's such a big part of these characters' lives, correct. It's fascinating to hear how people think so differently. You know, Jude is someone who's a fairly literal character with not much imagination, but the way he thinks and the way he perceives the world are ways I never would have thought of, but it took these lawyers and how they thought and how they worked through a problem and how they used language differently that really gave me insight into a way a different mind sees the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the law stuff, kind of as a very poor abstract thinker, I was particularly dazzled by the law sections, and as someone who has worked in and around the film business, I was both delighted and sometimes tickled with the film career that you give Willem.
My reader said Willem's films are very complicated, but the book is a fantasy on many levels,
sure.
And it's a fantasy in that way as well. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's a director of photography, and was shooting something while I was writing this book and talking to him. And one of the things that I was sort of most tickled by myself is the way he described a film set as a micro-society. And I'm always interested in micro-societies, you know, whether it's the micro-society of an invented island and a lab, as in my first book, or in this group of friends in this book. And just the rites and rituals of, you know, he described how, you know, at lunchtime, everyone scattered and sat at different tables. And there's a real sort of hierarchy of who's most important and everyone knows it. Or how, you know, there's a real infantilization of actors, how you get walked to and from everywhere. Mm-hmm. And you begin to understand both why actors, I mean, it's a horrible job. I mean, you're constantly being rejected and you're constantly being talked about as if you're not there. And yet you're also, you know, simultaneously, if you make it, you know, being treated sort of like, you know, Eloise, sort of this, you know, pampered baby.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, you know, you bring Willem from his, you know, beginning as a waiter, and then he, you know, kind of starts becoming a working actor, and then he has a series of unnamed spy movies, but I sort of imagine those to be like the Bourne movies a little bit, like sort of. And at one point you have him late in career, you have him starred, you mentioned parenthetically that he had starred in a remake of Desperate Characters. Those of you who may know this, Desperate Characters is a novel by Paula Fox, a wonderful novel, which I'm sure
that's
you
really
love, and I'm sure that's...
But
when I read that novel, it is about a woman who gets bitten by a cat, who may or may not be rabid. And I remember reading that book, and that's basically it. That's the story.
Yeah.
And I read it when I was a film executive in the 90s, and I thought, God, I said to someone, can you imagine taking a book like this? It's so brilliant. Imagine taking it into a pitch meeting and saying, I want to make a movie, Desperate Characters, about a woman who gets bitten by a cat. And the person said to me, well, you know, that was a movie.
Yeah.
And I said, what?
Yeah. I never saw it. I never saw it either.
Yeah. Yeah. With Shirley MacLaine.
I don't think anyone saw it.
So you mentioned a moment ago, you said it's a bit of a fairy tale.
Yeah.
And that actually is something that I thought about, and to a point of almost preoccupation as I was reading it, because I thought, you know, the greatest mistake a reader could make, and I'm sure some people made it, is reading this book as if it were a piece of straight mimetic realism.
Yeah.
Which it is, you know, it is obviously a novel of tremendously realistic, painfully persuasively realistic textures, but in many respects there is a you know, not just an enormity to it, but a distinctly fairy tale aspect, several fairy tale aspects. You know, and you know, the one thinks of fairy tales, and one thinks of, you know, you can look at the book as a fairy tale, as, you know, four people go to New York and they all experience enormous success,
right?
You know, right. And in the finest, you know, material lives in a way,
right?
But of course, there's the much more persuasive and interesting sense in which this is a fairy tale is in its darkest elements. And you know, many things that befall Jude feel like, you know, they actually seem to involve fairy tale motifs.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. I think that so much of this is borrowed directly from fairy tales. So many of the tropes and the visual cues. I mean, there's a repetition of forests, for example, which make a lot of appearances, and of dark rooms, which make a lot of appearances. There's the absence of parents. Mm-hmm. There's the absence of mothers. There's the absence of time. There's a child who has to go through, you know, terrific suffering, who's also an orphan. I mean, all of those are things that you find again and again, not just in Western fairy tales, but a lot of Eastern ones as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fairy tales are, and then, of course, the way that the characters talk and think and how they've been educated, what they expect from life, that is the stuff of the contemporary naturalistic novel. Mm-hmm. And the two together are not, you know, kind of, it's a strange arranged marriage. And so I think a lot of times what this book asks you to do is it asks you to surrender to a fantasy that's in a guise of a contemporary naturalistic novel. Mm-hmm. And I think as a reader, you either succumb to that or you don't. And if you don't, then there are going to be too many points that don't seem quite plausible enough or seem fantastic.
Right.
And so it does ask for a certain amount of surrender from the reader. And, you know, even you have to buy into this idea that Jude is as lovable as his friends seem to think he is. And if you don't, then he'll be a perplexing character, I think,
right,
in a very unsatisfying way.
Right. Right. Well, first of all, I'm curious about whether that was something that was part of your project from the beginning, or something that you sort of discovered that you found that you were doing, and you thought.
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I love fairy tales. It probably wasn't conscious, and then probably as I started moving into the second section, I knew it was. Mm-hmm. But it was always going to be a book that was going to be strange, I think, and was going to. I always wanted it to be something that would play sort of tricks on the reader, by which I mean I didn't want them to be gimmicky tricks, but I wanted the reader to feel unsteady. I wanted the reader to feel like they thought they were entering one kind of thing and they actually aren't. Mm-hmm. And I wanted them to feel the reader's reaction in a way to feel a little bit always as if they were walking on water or a waterbed. This kind of sense, which mimics how Jude feels his entire life. The sense of, I think this world is one thing, I think this is heading in one way, but I'm not really sure because I'm getting this cue and this cue and this cue.
Right. Right, a sense of disorientation.
Yes, yeah.
Right,
yeah, and unease, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I wonder too. We were starting to talk about this just a tiny bit backstage. The book begins in an undisclosed moment in the past, but at some, in the semi-recent past. At no point is the year fixed. There are very few. In fact, there are practically no. Historical signifiers,
right?
Very few geographic signifiers. Very few. Manhattan is a sort of forest of proper names, restaurant names,
right.
And theaters and plays. It's almost impossible to talk about, to say six sentences about Manhattan that don't involve, very specific things. Those things are omitted,
right?
And I'm curious how you came to that, because it's very hard to think of another novel about New York that.
Well, we're all so used to reading about New York in novels, and there are wonderful New York novels. Mm-hmm. But when you take away all current events and all context from a book, what you're really leaving the reader with is the interior world of these characters, and that's it. Mm-hmm. So you have a very intimate kind of, I hate to use this term because Instagram uses it about themselves, but it's a walled garden. It's a space that traps you in the particulars of these characters, and if it feels intimate, it also feels claustrophobic. Mm-hmm. And I really think it's a cheat when you're reading a book and someone drops in, a recent event, and you as the reader are then supposed to figure out what the character's emotional reaction is going to be.
Right.
To me, I've always been surprised. I mean, I understand why this book is marketed as a New York book, because it isn't in a conventional sense, I think. You're right, there are no exteriors in this book. Uh-huh. When insofar as there are locations, they're almost always inside something. They're in a basement, they're in a motel room, they're in a monastery, they're in an apartment, they're in a house, so they're always in something.
Right.
And there's very little view outside to the world in both senses. You never see nature in this book, or you rarely do, and you rarely get a sense of the world beyond this universe that these characters are in.
Right.
So that's the first thing. I think the other thing is, when you take out history and you take out current events from a book about a city as well known and as well written about as New York, what you're left with instead is sort of a psychological study of the city. Mm-hmm. And so you're left with an exploration of why people come to the city, who these people are, how they claim the city as their own, what they hope for. I mean, the character's success, I think, is particular to this book, and it's particular to this vision of New York, because, New Yorkers fetishize success. And I know groups of friends where the currency of that group is that everyone is successful.
Yes.
No matter how you define that term, and you'll go and they'll say, oh, well, here's my friend who's the lawyer, and here's my friend, who's a Broadway producer. And there's always a rattling off of credentials. And so for certain friend groups in New York, and I know a few of them, these characters' lives, how they are self-congratulatory about one another's success, is very normal. And of course, it's not like that everywhere. And it's one of the things that makes New York fascinating, and it's also one of the things that makes it a city of douchebags, So it's both, but it is inextricable from the experience of being in New York. The other thing is sort of the ambition that that everyone in New York has. It is too difficult a city to live in unless you are really on the make for something. And that, in that sense, I think this is a New York book.
Right.
It's about why people come and why they stay. But it's not about the events of the city as they affect these characters.
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, I mean, but I we talked about this. You know, books that I thought about while I was reading, I thought about Another Country, you know, an unbelievably great New York book. American Psycho, an unbelievably
love,
great New York book.
Yeah, that's a great New York book.
And you know, I found it really fascinating. You know, I certainly didn't mean it as kind of bracket the book in some.
No, you know, I mean American Psycho. You know, we were talking backstage, and it's. I think that's a brilliant book. It's also a fairy tale.
Right.
And he does the exact opposite. It's brand name after brand name after brand name. Mm-hmm. And it's specificity after specificity after specificity to pin you in a very specific place. And yet the actual outlines of the story, so it is a reverse,
right,
as you were saying, of this book. The outlines of the story are fantastical.
Right.
And what keeps it earthbound are those details and those sorts of name checks.
Right. Whereas in your book sort of has this kind of wonderfully almost aqueous interiority where you're so within these people, you know.
Right.
Well, I know we had talked before that you do not feel like reading from the book, but I thought perhaps I would read a short passage.
That's great.
It was a moment, but both so that you can... Yeah, we were. Yeah. I was trying to convince
Matthew
her.
Matthew will be better.
She was like, "I hate doing it." So, and it feels very odd to sort of like, you know, I don't mean to take over the experience, but this is all Hanya, not me. The reason I sort of zeroed in on this passage was because it's relatively late in the book, but it struck me as sort of a moment where the book was sort of, I felt this kind of concentration where I thought, this is, you know, this is a place where the book is telling us something about how to read it, or what to extract. And also because it's a funny passage. It's momentarily funny because it contains within it, you'll remember when Willem is reading a beat of dialogue from If This Were a Movie.
Oh, right.
And you're sort of making fun of a sort of pretentious collegiate playwright. It's besides that wonderful in its own way. So, this is a passage that, just to give you a little context, is within the, it's taking place within the head of Willem. That's the he who's speaking here is Willem, the actor. And it starts with him. He's meditating on he's being unfaithful to his partner, which is just probably the one thing you need to know. It saddened him, of course, that his sex life and his home life should have to be two distinct realms, but he was old enough now to know that within every relationship was something unfulfilled and disappointing, something that had to be sought elsewhere. His friend Roman, for example, was married to a woman who, while beautiful and loyal, was famously unintelligent. She didn't understand the films Roman was in, and when you talked to her, you found yourself consciously recalibrating the velocity and complexity and content of your conversation, because she so often looked confused when the talk turned to politics or finance or literature or art or food or architecture or the environment. What could they talk about? He knew that Roman was well aware, was aware of this deficiency in both Lisa and in his relationship. Ah, well, he had once said to Willem, unprompted, if I want good conversation, I can talk to my friends, right? Roman had been among the first of his friends to get married, and at the time he had been fascinated by and disbelieving of his choice. But now he knew. You always sacrifice something. The question was what you sacrificed. He knew that to some people, JB, Roman probably, his own sacrifice would be unthinkable. It would have been once to him as well. He thought frequently these days of a play he had done in graduate school, by a beatily plotting woman in the playwriting division who had gone on to have great success as a writer of spy movies, but who in graduate school had tried to write Pinteresque dramas about unhappy married couples. If This Were a Movie, it was about an unhappy married couple. He was a professor of classical music. She was a librettist who lived in New York. Because the couple was in their 40s, at the time a gray-colored land, impossibly far and unimaginably grim, they were devoid of humor and in a constant state of yearning for their younger selves, back when life had actually seemed so full of promise and hope, back when they had been romantic, back when life itself had been a romance. He had played the husband, and while he had long ago realized that it had been really an awful play, it had included lines like, "This isn't Tosca, you know, this is life!" He had never forgotten the final monologue he had delivered in the second act when the wife announces that she wants to leave, that she doesn't feel unfulfilled, that she doesn't feel fulfilled in their marriage, that she's convinced that someone better awaits her, Seth. But don't you understand, Amy? You're wrong. Relationships never provide you with everything. They provide you with some things. You take all the things you want from a person, sexual chemistry, let's say, or good conversation, or financial support, or intellectual compatibility, or niceness, or loyalty, and you get to pick three of those things. Three. That's it. Maybe four if you're very lucky. The rest you have to look for elsewhere. It's only in the movies that you find someone who gives you all those things. But this isn't the movies. In the real world, you have to identify which three qualities you want to spend the rest of your life with, and then you look for those qualities in another person. That's real life. Don't you see it's a trap? If you keep trying to find everything, you'll wind up with nothing. Amy, crying. So what did you pick? Seth. I don't know. Beat. I don't know. At the time, he hadn't believed these words, because at the time, everything really did seem possible. He was 23, and everyone was young and attractive and smart and glamorous. Everyone thought they would be friends for decades, forever. But for most people, of course, that hadn't happened. As you got older, you realized that the qualities you valued and the people you slept with or dated weren't necessarily the ones you wanted to live with or be with or plod through your days with. If you were smart and if you were lucky, you learned this and accepted this. You figured out what was most important to you and you looked for it and you learned to be realistic. They all chose differently. Roman had chosen beauty, sweetness, pliability. Malcolm, he thought, had chosen reliability and competence. Sophie was intimidatingly efficient. And aesthetic compatibility. And he had chosen friendship, conversation, kindness, intelligence. When he was in his 30s, he had looked at certain people's relationships and asked the question that had and continued to fuel countless dinner party conversations. What's going on there? Now, though, as an almost 48-year-old, he saw people's relationships as reflections of their keenest yet most inarticulable desires, their hopes and insecurities taking shape physically in the form of another person. Now he looked at couples in restaurants on the street and at parties and wondered, why are you together? What did you identify as essential to you? What's missing in you that you want someone else to provide? He now viewed a successful relationship as one in which both people had recognized the best of what the other person had to offer and had chosen to value it as well. And perhaps not coincidentally, he found himself doubting therapy, its promises for the first time. He had never before questioned that therapy was at worst a benign treatment. When he was younger, he had even considered it a form of luxury, this right to speak about his life essentially uninterrupted for 50 minutes, proof that he had somehow become someone whose life deserved such lengthy consideration, such an indulgent listener. But now he was conscious of his own impatience with what he had begun to see as the sinister pedantry of therapy, its suggestion that life was somehow reparable, that there existed a societal norm, and that the patient was being guided towards conforming to it.
Good, Matthew. Thank you.
That's a great passage for a million different reasons.
Well, thank you. You know, I showed that to my friend. He's like, this sounds like you're writing about New York apartments. Sounds like a real estate speech.
Really? You know?
You get to pick vermin-free.
Right.
Or sunlight.
Right.
Or washer dryer.
Right.
Or balcony, but you can't pick all of them.
Well, yeah. The book also has beautiful renderings and things to say about New York real estate. But it struck me that a couple of the book's kind of central things do get articulated in that passage.
One
of them is the little tag at the end where he talks about the sinister pedantry of therapy and the idea that life is correctable.
Right.
And that seems
I once said this and then I started getting letters from psychologists, so please don't send me letters. But I did think that, you know, it's a psychological book that's suspicious of therapy. It just is. And one of the things I personally don't trust about therapy is it is insistent. I know people are going to protest, but it is insistent on the fact that life can get better. Mm-hmm. And I think for some people, it doesn't and it can't. And, you know, a friend of mine actually had a very nice way of putting it. For some people, she said, the best you can hope for is an accommodation with life, which I thought was a very beautiful way of stating it.
Right.
And I do think that, you know, we are told that if we try hard enough, if we work hard enough, we can correct or we can repair or we can overcome. And I simply don't think that's true for everyone. Mm-hmm. It is for a lot of people and it helps many people, but I don't think it helps everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's certainly, certainly so, mm. You know, and I think, you know, and I think part of this book's, you know, kind of curious sleight of hand is that even though it doesn't necessarily help Jude, you know, I mean, and therapy is something that he comes up against, though not particularly exhaustively.
No.
You know, it still seems as if, you know, Jude fulfills himself. You know, there is when I first came across the first literal referent in the text to the words "a little life," I was startled, right? Because they occur in a context that those words would seem to mean something, and when they occur as, you know, the phrase "a little life," I sort of went, "Oh my God, that's incredibly upsetting." But then later in the text, when Jude is sort of reflecting upon the meaning and utility of his life, the title kind of reestablishes itself in another way.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's more meant as that second reference than.
Yeah. Yeah. That's clear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. But you know, also, I suppose, you know, that we've talked, and I'm sure you've talked endlessly about the aspects of the book that are gruesome or painful or you know, shocking. But of course, there is also the great theme of what these friendships are worth.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I think that, you know, friendship is a relationship in our age that is fairly devalued, or devalued more than it has been. You know, for centuries, it was something that was perhaps the paramount relationship in one's life, because it was the first one you chose. I mean, the first time you make a friend, it is an announcement of self to the world. This is who I am choosing to be mine. And, you know, until, you know, not too long ago, marriage was something that united kingdoms or clans or, you know, dynasties. And so you couldn't pick your spouse. You couldn't pick your parents. You can't pick your family. You can't often pick your business partners. But your friend is the person you can pick. And it's around that person who you become who you are, whoever that is, for better and for worse. And, you know, did anyone read Vivian Gornick's The Odd Woman in the City, which came out recently?
Yeah, I did.
I love that book. And she reminds us in that book that, you know, this idea of friendship not being central to fiction in particular, or to writing in general, is a fairly new phenomenon. She uses the example of Coleridge and Wordsworth, and how, you know, again, in previous centuries, a friend was someone to whom you showed your most virtuous self, to whom you showed the best of yourself. And the idea that a friend is someone to whom you confess the worst of yourself is a relatively new phenomenon. And I thought, oh God, I'm really screwed, because I mean, that's like, you know, that's essentially what this book is. But it reminded me that, you know, friendship between men in particular, but friendship in general, has been a great subject and has been a rich vein for literature for hundreds of years in many, many cultures.
Right.
And then it's sort of, it slipped out of favor in favor of sort of, you know, capital R romances. Mm-hmm. But at the heart of this book is a romance. It's a romance between two people who find that the kind of relationship that develops between them doesn't really have a name and isn't really recognized, I suppose, by culture at large.
Right.
And when two people in a friendship feel that, you know, I often feel about my best friend, I wish there were a different word that announced us to the world, that, because the word friend is so, you know, it's so common these days, and it's so like the word love, and you wish that you could keep something about that relationship sacrosanct, that it told the world, you know, this is somebody to me that I can't quite express, and it's not a romance, it's not sexual, it's not marriage, it's not this, it's not that, it's this. And there isn't that word.
Right.
But I did want to create that in this book, a friendship that felt almost otherworldly, but isn't, because it really is only about the sort of expansiveness of what friendship is, you know, that it really is, the relationship itself can, you know, can be as capacious as we need it to be. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we forget that, because it's not something that is codifiable.
Right.
And so therefore, I think we sometimes think of it as less than.
Right. It's interesting, you know, you said this, and I thought, you know, maybe that the kind of examination of what friendship is feels especially vibrant. You alluded to, you know, Instagram using the phrase "a webbed garden," and of course the very notion of a friend has been rather co-opted by and I love that you mentioned the Odd Woman in the City, which is a wonderful book.
It's a really great book.
It's actually a book that was given to me by my first best reader.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a wonderful novelist named Catherine Taylor, who I think is.
It's a different kind of meditation on friendship and
exactly.
and also in New York and in an unusual way.
Right, right. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Because it's so different.
Yeah.
From this. While we were backstage, I think I overheard Louise say that you wrote this book in 18 months.
Yeah.
Which seems like quite a wonderful sprint.
Yeah.
or a frantic yeah. one. But you know, that's fast for 900.
It is fast, but the first one took 18 years, mm-hmm. and it just took 18 years because I procrastinated for years on end. And but when I look back on it, I'm glad I didn't choose to wait that long, but I'm glad it actually happened slowly for a few reasons. I mean, when I look back at the earlier drafts of The People in the Trees, I was 22, and I was so... When you're 22 and you're writing a character who's 70, you think a 70-year-old sounds a certain way, mm-hmm. and that's very florid and with a lot of sort of references to the past, you know? And and then as you get older, you become less self-conscious on the page, and you become less... You start fearing age less.
Right.
And you start also fetishizing it less, and it
right.
becomes easier to write. The other thing is, you know, we talked a little bit about this. When you're an aspiring novelist and you're in your 20s, you think, oh my God, I'm going to write this novel, I'm going to get it published, and then I'm going to be who I'm meant to be. And that's actually not the way it is. You
right.
publish a novel, and then you're just someone who's published a novel.
Right.
And so when you publish a novel and you're middle-aged, you better be something else by that
right.
point. You know, you better have other ways that you define yourself. And so I did. And it means the failures of it mean... I mean, they're still stinging and awful, and you feel like a failure, but it
right.
means ultimately less because life has gone on before it and life will continue to go on after it. Writing this book in particular in 18 months, it was a great experience. I mean, it was awful because it felt unmanageable at certain points. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as anyone here who's an artist knows, when you are lucky enough to know where you're going with your work and you really feel that the road ahead of you is so clear and you can just keep driving all the way down it. It's so rare and you just want to go for as long as you can. And that happened in great stretches with this book. And it's a thrilling sensation. It doesn't matter what you're writing. It doesn't matter if it's dark. It doesn't matter if it's difficult. It's the one point in your life in which you feel utterly in control.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't happen that often. And you can't summon it and then it leaves.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, sorry.
And then you're left with the great humbling or humiliating experience of publishing a book, which seems even when it goes well to be oddly calamitous.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it is the one time when you have the most control over what you're doing is before you show it to anyone and while you're just alone with the draft.
When you're alone with it.
Yeah.
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 It's really amazing that way. I had a question that was developed. Oh yes, when you said a 22-year-old who sounds florid on the, you know, that thinks that a 70-year-old, that made me think. You mean like the Friends as reimagined by Bruce?
Oh God, I was telling Matthew that. So the way a book gets published is, you know, your editor buys it, and then they have something called sales conference where they have to sell it in to the sales staff. And in order for a book to really find buyers from bookstores, you have to have the sales staff behind you, and so they've got to get drummed up. It's like that, you know. It's like when Paul Allen used to go yell at the Microsoft engineers. You know, it's a little bit like that. It's like some sort of like, you know, fascist conference. And so Jerry, my editor, presented this book. I was telling Matthew, the way he pitched it was, imagine Friends as rewritten by Marcel Proust. He told me he was so proud of it, and it was the worst description I'd ever heard. I didn't know what to say. He was so pleased with himself, and I just sort of hit delete on the email because I understood his difficulty. It's a difficult book to do a one-line pitch about.
Right.
And it's, I don't know how I would have done it either. I mean, it was a big problem for us. And you kind of have to, I mean, it's another case in which, you know, you kind of have to trick the reader, but not just trick the reader. I mean, we didn't know what to say about it.
Right.
So I think I could have done better than Friends by Marcel Proust, but I can't imagine what that would be.
Right, no, nor can I.
I mean, maybe Girls by Larry Kramer. I mean, I don't know.
That's
the
actually
girls by Tony Kushner.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's actually much better.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Infinitely
I'll
better.
I'll tell him that.
Yeah.
I'll tell him
yeah,
that.
That's actually that's, yeah, quite
I would
brilliant.
Read that, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I wouldn't
sure.
read Friends by Marcel Proust.
God, no.
Jerry, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, which is why book people make terrible marketers.
Right, you know? Right. So, but he fought with you about the cover, too. The cover is, of course, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
The cover's really... I mean, I love... This is the thing I'm proudest of. So the cover is by a photographer named Peter Hujar, who was a contemporary of David Voinovich's and Keith Haring's and Chen Guangqi's and Nan Golden's. And part of the 70s and 80s East Village arts and AIDS activism scene. And it was taken in 1969, and it's from a series called Orgasmic Men. This is called Orgasmic Man 1. And the thing I loved about this photograph, and the reason I knew right away it was right, you know, my best friend had suggested it to me.
Oh, is that right?
And, yeah, and the second I saw it, I thought, this is it. You don't know whether he's in pleasure or in pain, but you do know that you are trespassing upon a moment of unbearable intimacy, and that there is a sense that you, the viewer, are violating someone at their kind of worst, most tender, rawest moment. And in that way, I thought it was sort of a wonderful way of visually articulating what I hope the book would be as well, mm-hmm. that you are witnessing someone in this moment in which he is completely naked, you know, before you. It's a cover that intends to and tries to elicit a response from the viewer, and the book tries to do the same. So then I fought with a long time with the house about this, uh-huh. you know. They thought it was, you know, too erotic. They thought it was, you know, clear that he was coming. I mean, it went on and on and on. And but in the end, I think it's sort of the best depiction of what the book is.
It's fantastic.
So I recently found out from the photographer's estate, he died of complications from AIDS in 1987, and his estate is managed by this very interesting guy named Stephen Koch, and he said, I found out who the guy is. His name is Dutch Anderson, and there's no record of him, so no one knows if he's alive, he still could be, mm-hmm. Or more likely if he's dead, and if so, when he died, and... And
what's the timestamp on the photograph?
It was 69.
Oh, 69. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I love it. It just looks so, except for his sideburns, it looks so contemporary and so fresh.
Right. And like
taken
no other.
Yesterday. Yeah.
Right. Like
yeah.
no other book.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting the when you talk about trespassing upon, you know, the reader feels as if they're trespassing. You know, while I was reading and preparing for this, I stumbled, I mean, one hardly had to stumble because people were talking about it everywhere, but I stumbled on a couple of people, posting about it on social media, and you know, kind of, there would be these kind of chorus of people saying, oh my God, I'm reading it. You know, it's so fantastic, I'm never speaking to the person who recommended it to me again. You know, it's a book where people take internalize the pain of it, you know, very... you know, not just passionately, but they're, you know, people are upset with it. They, you know,
right.
Were you expecting that? But you know,
no, I wasn't. I mean, my first reader didn't have any emotional reaction. I mean,
right.
He was sort of upset, but mildly. I mean, and my editor didn't really, and neither did my agent. So it's the fervor and the intensity of the reaction has been. An honor, but it's been a surprise as well.
Right.
I mean, you know, but I did write, and I told my reader this, I wanted this to be a book that did elicit reaction, that really demanded people, if they were going to surrender to it, would really have some sort of reaction. I didn't want people to say, well, I'm done with it. I mean, I think that, you know, it is really greedy for your time and for your sort of emotional involvement.
Yes.
And I did it because that was the kind of book I wanted to read. I mean, I think that it's not something that we see at this current literary moment that much. I mean, the book feels, and I didn't quite realize this as I was writing it, but I understand it now better. It feels kind of out of time, in not only because there are no times, but because I think it feels a little bit like a throwback. You know, it doesn't feel, it's definitely not meta, and it's not distanced, and it's not... removed. It really is not shy about asking readers to sort of get in there with it.
Right.
And that's not something that I think we see that much of in this current literary climate.
Right.
And I'm not saying it's bad or good. It's just I think that's what people sometimes characterize as its throwback quality, I think, is that.
Right. It's not trying to you know, dazzle you with some, you know, kind of or you know, it feels like it's trying to involve you.
Yeah,
you know, psychologically, I mean, as opposed to on the level of, you know, storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, I think right. of this as an experimental book in a lot of ways, and there's a lot of literary trickery, tricks in it too. I mean,
sure.
But I hope that for most readers, they don't feel those tricks; they feel something else. And if you're looking for it as a sort of a textual experiment, you can find, I hope, lots and lots of little in jokes and nods and experimentations.
Right.
But if you choose not to see them, then it shouldn't bother you either.
Right. Right. And the point of engagement is profoundly psychological.
Right.
Right. As opposed to just narrative and a reminder. You know, I in just a moment we just about time to I think open the floor to questions. But I was struck. I started reading this book immediately after reading a book I won't name, but a very long novel that came with a lot of you know, ballyhoo.
Oh, yeah.
And I got depressed by it because I thought, you know, this is a 1,000-page novel. I guess I kind of just...
Yeah.
that doesn't actually need to be 1,000 pages. And I thought, you know, what, like, do novels need to be that anymore? We have television to tell us long stories, you know? Okay? Like, is a long novel necessary or even plausible anymore? And I picked this up and I thought, absolutely. Here is a novel doing something
that only
a novel can do at length.
I mean, I would rather write short novels. I mean, some of the best recent fiction is short.
Yes.
And it's much harder to do. I mean, to write a disciplined, economical, 240-page book and to conjure an entire world. I mean, one of my favorite contemporary novels is Mona Simpson's Off Keck Road, which is a novella. It's you know, probably less than 200 pages.
Right.
But it's about a single life, lived in a small town in Wisconsin, in Eau Claire or something. And it's really perfect. I mean, it is a really perfectly carved story of a small life lived in full without condescension. And it's a really perfect book. It's very, very hard to write a book like that.
It's a beautiful book.
Yeah.
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 I agree.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we can open the floor to people who have questions. Yep.
Okay.
Hi.
I'll say it. So one of the, I guess, looming, you know, sub-themes of the book is classical music, and especially with Jude and how you make him a singer. I also appreciated the fact they used Ich bin der Welt for him to sing to Harold. I was just curious, kind of, the role of classical music in your life and why you chose to kind of impart that on Jude's character and have him, you know, be a singer.
Well, I mean... The book is arranged like a symphony. It's structured like a symphony. So, and a lot of the things, the little themes that come up, the cutting, for example, I really wanted to feel like a little bit of melody that loops in again and again and again, just to remind the reader, you're in this symphony, you're in this symphony, you're in this symphony. And I also thought of it structurally as a symphony because I wanted it to have a fairly rigid framework. You know, it's seven parts. Within each part, except for the seventh, there's three sections, within each of the sections, there's three subsections. And so there's some deviations. And then on top of that, I wanted to pile lots of other things, you know, excess upon excess upon excess. But I wanted the reader to feel that there was a solid strut work beneath him. And so in that way, it's a nod to classical music. You know, my father listened to opera when I was growing up, and I always had it around me. I'm not a great student of it, but he listened to a number of German songs and German Lieder, and I suppose the love of it in this book is a nod to him.
Great.
Thank you.
Great. Somebody else?
Hi, thanks.
Hi.
I'm curious about the process. So talking about the novel that took you 18 years, I think you said, and then this book being 18 months. So I think you described it really beautifully, the sort of process of being so into it and so, you know, knowing the path that you were going on. So can you talk about outside of your work, what that was like? Were you not able to talk to people about this book during those 18 months?
I just didn't, you know, I mean, so at the time when I was writing this book, I was actually only working 4 days a week, and working 4 days a week is really great. I mean, when you have that fifth day off, it's like having 2 days off. I mean, it's, you really learn how to structure your time when you're working a day job and you're doing this at night, and I write at night much more clearly. Your hours become intense. So from Monday to Thursday, I would write from 9 to 12 at night, and then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I would write 6 hours every day. But the nice thing was, and you're right, when you have a day job and you're writing a book that's as demanding as this, it's a relief to get to work. You know, I mean, at work, you know, you just spend most of your time, you know, shooting the shit and, you know, gossiping and stirring up trouble, and, you know, and your problems are really earthbound, and it's a relief. It was a relief to be able to go and for 9 hours not have to think about the world of this book. And of course, there were times when I wished I were still in it, or I wished I could get back to it. But it was it's a good check on one's sanity and also on one's perspective. You come in the end of the night, rather, after a day at work, and you're just able to sort of have come in from a palate cleanser, as it were.
Yeah, I was wondering, in your work life as an editor, how do you sort of see the relationship between the work that you do that's sort of work play, which is this writing, not that it's play, but then sort of the actual work, how do they sort of cross-pollinate each other?
I mean, it's a good question. When you're magazine editing has given me a lot of skills, I think, but they're not very glamorous sounding skills. But I think what it teaches you how to do is it teaches you how to structure and how to pace. And those aren't things that get discussed a lot when we talk about the craft of writing fiction, but they're terrifically important. And structure in particular is something that I think I'm good at. I know I'm good at it as an editor. I can have a piece that's 5,000 words long or 50,000 words long, and I'll know how to reorder it. And it's so, I think, important, especially when you are trying to sort of take chances and be experimental with the way you're delivering a novel, to have, to be able to understand the sort of terra firma that you're giving to the reader, and that's all structure. And it's true with every single magazine piece. Of course, there's other things that are important in magazine pieces, the quality of the reporting, the characterization, the writing itself, and on and on and on. But the first thing a magazine editor looks for is structure. And that's been terrifically helpful. The second thing, as I mentioned, is pace. Just that you want to make sure that you keep the reader moving through, whether it's a 500-word piece, again, or, you know, a 200,000-word book. And the third thing, and this says really deeply unglamorous, but it's really true, you want to, and I ask for this from my writers too, have respect for your reader, and that means turning in as clean a draft as possible. It means, you know, that words are spelled right. It means that, you know, that your historical references are checked. It means that you've done your reporting. And again, these all sound like silly things, but you have to be able to respect whoever's reading your book enough to get those things right. And I guess the fourth thing is it teaches you that you've got to file it at some point. And I think for fiction writers in particular, there's a sense of, it's never going to get there. I'm going to keep fiddling. It's going to get better. It won't get better after a certain point. You know, it will get as good as you can make it, and then you're going to need to turn it over. And so the magazine editing makes you unsentimental about that. After a certain point, you've got to turn it into your editor. And again, this is a very sort of obvious and not sexy sounding skill, but it's a reminder that I see every day. And magazine writers in general are very good about turning it in. Sometimes you wish they wouldn't turn it in so fast, but they know that nothing is going to, it will never get better until they turn it in. Thanks.
Hi. So I had a question about how is it you investigated, or who did you speak to while you were writing, or as you were writing, the relationship that Jude had with Caleb, because that's kind of where I'm at the book right now,
right.
And I was just like stunned by it, and immediately like having incredibly like, visceral response to that, and it's kind of interesting being, you know, you being a woman writing about something that's not even discussed about in like the gay community,
right?
And it's, yeah, and it just, and it's intriguing, I mean, so many ways. I like, you wrote about something very, very well, I guess. I don't know.
Well, thank you. I mean, it, I know it happens.
And I say this as a survivor, so.
I mean, I know it happens a lot, and it's, you're right, it's not that discussed. I mean, with Caleb, who's, with whom Jude has a disastrous relationship, it's, I do think that, you know, there are certain people who, having suffered trauma or abuse, find themselves going back to it again and again and again. And this pattern, this miserable pattern of somehow finding their way to people who will hurt them, almost you know, beyond their control and beyond their will, sort of replicates itself with this sort of dreary and dismaying sameness. And I also think there are people who can smell damage on other people and prey on them. And you know, when I was having my reader read this section, he was saying, he put it, I think, interestingly, he said that it would have taken someone as wolfish as Caleb, which I thought was a good word, in order to make Jude go out with him. And there are people, we've all sensed that they are dangerous in some way, and that in some way, and in some way we're responding to them because we know that they are a fulfillment of what we dread most about ourselves. And so it seemed right for this character that that would be the sort of person to whom he would be drawn for his first real relationship.
Yeah.
Okay. I really loved what you had to say about friendship and this sort of deep longing and need for an enduring friendship, a long friendship that evolves as Jude's and Willem's does. And it brought to mind Elena Ferrante and the Neapolitan quartet. Do you think that in part the great success and attraction of A Little Life and of her book, her series of books, has to do with not only that portrayal of a deep friendship, but the evolution that that friendship goes through?
You know, I think that's a great question. I haven't read the Elena Ferrantes. I've only read My Days of Abandonment. Yeah. I haven't, you know, it's one of those things where when you're writing a book, you think, oh, I'm going to save this, and then you just never get to it. But so I'm going to. But I do think that, I wonder if one of our current cultural fascination with friendships is due in part to the fact that you have a whole generation of people being raised for whom the word means something quite different. It yeah. means it's something that's branded. It's something that's corporate speak almost.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a sort of collective nostalgia for what the word once meant and what it might mean again. And the thing about friendships is that you realize that in their ungovernability, you know, it's been, I always think, I was, you know, when my editor said, well, why don't these two characters, you'll know who I mean, I don't want to spoil it, get married. And to me, they never were going to get married. They were people who really didn't think they needed a relationship that was going to be legalized by the state. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if, in part, we are craving the inherent democracy of what a friendship can be, even with all of its thorniness and complications and difficulties. Because it is the one thing that, even as adults now, even in an era in which we can control so little, we can try to control that to some extent. So that's my theory, but it's a good question. It's a good think piece for someone, maybe for T Magazine.
Yeah. Wonderful.
That's our last question. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.